The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto-renews.
What's up? It's Kaylee Cuoco. When it comes to travel, we all have a happy place. I just went to my happy place. I just went to Maui, and it was truly amazing. Priceline has always been about getting you to your happy place for a happy price, with deals you really can't find anywhere else, like up to 60% off select hotels in Costa Rica or 5-star hotels for 2-star prices in Cabo.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
At Kroger, we know the minute a tomato is picked off the vine, the fresh timer starts. The sooner we get our produce to you, the fresher it is. That's why we've completely overhauled our process to shorten the time from harvest to home for our tomatoes, strawberries, and salads. Because we know how much you love fresh produce, we give you more time to enjoy your tasty fruits and veggies at home. So whether you're shopping in-store, picking up, or prefer delivery, we're committed to bringing you the freshest produce possible. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This week on Red Inca, we chat about the many traditions in cricket and how they have changed over and over and over again. So I brought my friend on to chat all about them.
My name is Neil Mathorpe and I'm unemployed.
Manners and I spent a lot of time touring together over the last few years, including sharing a hotel room at one stage. So I know what pisses him off and I know what pisses me off. And that's mostly people whining about the game when they know next to nothing about it. What people often call tradition is usually just what they can remember. And so this episode is clearing up just how much cricket has changed over the years. So Manners, when I said I wanted to get you on this podcast, I said, you know, what are you passionate about? And you have somehow turned that into what are your bugbears? And so we're going to talk about the people in cricket who call themselves traditionalists and talk about how much they love the game and actually have no idea about the traditions of the game and how much it has changed. This game has changed so much, Manners.
You know, that's once a subject that I have absolutely no indifference to. I either completely leave it or I get really hot under the collar. People will say, just leave this game alone. It's perfectly fine. It's been going for 140 years. Why do you want to keep changing it? Well, I've got a list which has doubled in length since you and I exchanged notes over this. I've got like 30 key aspects of the game, and only one, maybe we'll save this till the end, that I can find has not been changed at some point.
Very interesting. Well, I'm going to go through a couple of the worst ones just off the top of my head. The super sub condition in one day cricket, where they basically came up with a plan where you couldn't use your super sub in any way, shape or form to help your cricket team. And I can't remember what period it was. I think it was just before World War One. They looked at having nets around the grounds, and it was some sort of extra boundary section that they were looking for. Those are about the only two that I can think of that were absolutely horrendous. There are some others that haven't worked for many different reasons, but start me off. Where are we going, Manners?
Where to start? Well, the length of an over, the length of a test match. That's the one that really got me hot under collar just recently, when people saying, test cricket has always been 5 days. Leave it alone. Why do you want to make it 4 days? And I do get a bit animated about this because, do you know what? As long as conditions are the same for the two teams playing, fine. So the Ashes, why can't you leave the Ashes at 5 days? That's an iconic test series. Why can't you leave England-India? The really big test series. But if Afghanistan play Ireland in a test series, if they want to play each other and lose $1 million a game, why would you want them to play it over 5 days? It's a nonsense, isn't it? I mean, and for a scheduling point of view, for countries like South Africa, Sri Lanka, or, you know, the test-playing countries, which are also losing money, it makes perfect sense. Thursday to Sunday, 3 days off. Thursday to Sunday, three test series in 3 weeks. So I understand the arguments, and you make several very good ones for why it will change test cricket. But think of all the things that have changed test cricket. It's a fundamentally different game. I mean, number of bounces per over. That's the one that really gets me. You know, in 1991, number of bounces was limited for the first time because the rest of the world had to find a way to stop the West Indies from beating everybody. But there's so many aspects of the game that have changed absolutely fundamentally. So don't get so hot under the collar about four-day cricket.
It's quite interesting. I don't know how many people know that it started as a three-day affair in England. So it was 3 days in England, 5 days in Australia, and there was obviously often four-day tests. There were timeless tests, not to mention the amount of tests that we had where we had a break in the middle, a rest day. What a phenomenal thing to think of now that we literally just went, everyone needs a Tuesday off, don't they? Let's have a break here. Timeless tests, I think, are one of the more overrated concepts, only because I don't think we actually had that many timeless tests that went timeless, if you know what I mean. Like, generally, they didn't go on. But the truth of the matter is, I think there's a real concern that England, Australia and India might turn around to all the smaller countries and go, you're not worth 5 days. And I can see why people would come up with that. But the idea that cricket is traditionally a five-day sport, well, it's not based in any facts that I can find. In the same way that when the 100 came out, Manners, everyone was so worried about the length of an over. I'm pretty sure when my father played cricket in Australia, he played 8-ball overs.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. And we had 4-ball overs as well in the 50s. 30s. Yep. And in fact, we had Australia and New Zealand was the last country to give up 8-ball overs, weren't they? It makes sense. I mean, you use up a lot of time changing overs. I mean, you know, why not have 8-ball overs? I think it makes a great deal of sense. And in fact, have 10-ball overs. If we're worried about not getting enough cricket in, let's talk about it. I don't think that anything should be off limits. Explore the options, because as I said, everything has been changed at some point or another. And people who get worried about test cricket say that it's dying and we need to make it more sexy and more interesting and appealing to the youngsters. That in itself is a cricketing tradition that's over a century old. I mean, that's why the Tri-Series was staged in 1911, England, South Africa and Australia, because they thought that test cricket was boring and it was putting people off. So they had to get three teams together. It's brilliant. Oh, names and numbers on shirts. That's the other one that has been getting people really, really hot under the collar. And the traditionalists said, you know, oh, it just won't be the same. You know, test cricket is tradition. I tell you what, Jared, in the sort of late 80s, when I was trying to become a commentator, and even into the early 90s, I used to go down to nets and practice matches and watch cricketers for hours and hours and hours so that I could identify them under a broad-brimmed sun hat from 120 yards away. And it was a tough skill to master, and I didn't always get it right, but it went down for hours and hours practicing. And I have to say that in the intervening 30-odd years, I have often thought, what an absolute waste of time. It may be a good skill, but of what practical use is it? So brilliant. Names and numbers on shirts. And you know what? Where are the traditionalists now? I mean, all that kerfuffle and unhappiness about it. And like all the other changes, it's just been accepted.
And it's one of those changes that why that really annoyed me was I grew up at the MCG, and as you know, you are so far from the action. Even if you're on the boundary, you're so far from the action. So if you're way back, I remember taking my girlfriend once and she just couldn't work out who the players were. It was actually, I think it was Victoria versus India. It was I took her to a warm-up game. That's the kind of romance that that I do. I actually took her because I told her she'd be able to watch Sachin Tendulkar back. And then the game was called off before Sachin came in. But that's another story for another day. But essentially, for newer fans, it's a great thing. And for us, it just doesn't matter. I saw Jim Maxwell. Jim Maxwell was so upset about it. He was saying that, and we both love Jim, but Jim was basically saying that, I hope they haven't brought this in for commentators. And it's like, no, we brought it in because of the amount of new, younger spectators that we want to actually love this game. We want them to know who that person is at all times and to get a better feeling of it. And I think that's what it actually does. So I think that's a perfect little change that actually could have a long effect on players. And it won't matter for you or me or hardcore cricket fans, but it might matter for other people. The 1910-1911 series, I had forgotten about that. That is certainly tri-series of test matches. What an incredible moment that was. Not only that, do you know, people talk about the golden era and how cricket was great in amateur. Do you know why a lot of the Australian players didn't turn up to that tour, man? As they were on strike.
Yeah, money dispute.
Yeah, that was one I noticed a lot when we did Death of a Gentleman. You go on these speaking tours and you go around, and eventually there'd always be this one guy, usually in some sort of knitted vest, who would come up and stand and go, don't you think everything could be fixed in cricket by just having amateur players play? And I was like, whoa. Me and Sam would race to get to this answer because we both are so passionate about this, even though Sam's from Eton and basically was an amateur cricketer, because we would say, how do you think Rashid Khan exists if you have amateur cricket? How do you think cricket grows if you have amateur cricket? Essentially, you would have a bunch of posh guys ripping off the system anyway. WG Grace was paid. So this whole idea that cricket was ever this holy thing, it's just, I think, I could be wrong, English journalists in the 1950s, just after World War II, looked back and just sort of pretended that all the normal parts of cricket didn't exist. And they went, oh, to only go back to those days. It's like, fuck off. Those days were horrible. WG Grace was a terrible fucking cheat. He would have got worse press today than KP.
Do you think so?
Yes, he was a cheat and a bully. He did things against the spirit of the game almost every game. You know the story about him running out? Was it Sammy Carter's? Goes down the wicket to take a piece of grass off the wicket, and WG Grace, you can't tell me John Etheridge in The Sun is going to be writing a good column about that. They'd be boots in at the journalists these days. It's complete nonsense. So my point is that amateurism is one of those things that people talk about. And realistically, professionalism has allowed us to have Irish cricketers, Afghanistani cricketers, Nepalese cricketers, and everyone else, and women cricketers. It's a brilliant thing. What else you got on your list?
Money was right behind the very foundation of why the game was played. And yeah, a lot of people think of match fixing as a modern phenomenon. Well, absolute nonsense. You know, you'd have the sort of Duke of Cornwall's 11 against the Earl of Sussex's 15. You know, where's that from, for a start? There'd be stories of the fiery fast bowler being poisoned the night before because these two landed gentry had put a massive wager on the game. It was professional, in a sense, from the very start. I've got loads on my list. Why don't players play in shorts? Why do we turn our nose up at shorts?
Yeah, I think you mentioned this one on WhatsApp. So, you know, I was there when Victoria played in shorts.
No, I didn't know that.
This is such a great story. So, essentially, they thought that they had to make domestic cricket more fun and they get more spectators. And so Victoria became the Victorian Bushrangers, right? And Victoria would play in shorts because people are just desperate to go down to the ground and watch cricketers in shorts. But there's a really funny thing because baseballers wear trousers as well. And it turns out in sports where you slide on hard surfaces, having trousers on is quite important. So what would happen to the Victorian players? The guys out in the outfield had no problems with the shorts and quite enjoyed it. The bowlers liked it, I think, as well. The guys around the square who had to dive all day would end up with just their knees tore apart. So there is actually, whether we knew this or not, there was a fundamental reason why we had it. But you're right. There is absolutely no reason why you can't wear shorts when you were playing cricket in certain positions.
The Victorians wore shorts in that was the 70s, wasn't it, or early 80s?
It was 93 or 94, the year that they did it.
Okay, it wasn't pre-Velcro then. They didn't have those buckles on the pads that they...
No.
You wouldn't want to be putting those on with shorts.
That would have been around the time that Velcro had taken over. Yeah, you're right. Oh my God. Do you remember going to training with it, with the buckle pads, and you just get it wrong and pick the back of your calf?
Yeah.
Again, another innovation that has managed to move our game on. Velcro. Who would have thought that was one of them? But that shows that realistically, the Big Bash is just, a follow on from that moment. And Australian cricket at that stage was incredibly progressive. So you had the shorts. Teams weren't really known by their nicknames back then, were they? You know, so you had Australian teams doing that. England was still playing in whites for limited overs cricket. So Australia was ahead of the game for that day-night cricket. And then they tried day-night, four-day cricket. So I was at a bunch of games at the MCG in day-night, four-day cricket, where one game they used a yellow ball and another game they used an orange ball. Now, an orange ball at dusk turned out not the best idea. Very easy to see during the day and at night, not so much during dusk. But again, that showed that they were trying to get something. And I don't know how you feel about day-night cricket, test cricket, but I'm sure you're probably in favor of it. But for me, it's like, if you look at the TV ratings for the Wacker test compared to the TV ratings for every other test in Australia, it's off the charts because it's in peak viewing time for the eastern states. So they all tune in. Apparently, not as many people watch TV during the middle of the day. Who knew?
I am very much in favor of day-night cricket and was right from the outset. And again, you know, you remember all that the time when the talk was of staging the first ones, and the people said, oh, but the conditions will be so different. It'll just be unfair. And, you know, just the cricket is a daytime game. Oh, we're absolute rubbish. And you and I have done enough daytime test matches to see how conditions change from one day to another, or from the morning to the afternoon. So playing a couple of hours under floodlights, I'm getting suitably hot under the collar again now. Let's go to pitches, shall we? Let's go to pitches. Pitch has always been cut. No. Not only has the pitch always been covered, it used to be completely uncovered, remain uncovered. It wasn't until 1910 that cricket started covering pitches at the end of play overnight. And then it was only the pitch ends, wasn't it? And since then, so then it was the pitch ends, then the whole pitch, then the bowler's run-ups, then the whole of the square. And then there was a debate about leaving the pitch uncovered and just covering up the bowlers' run-ups. So you would have had fast bowlers running in like Merv Hughes on damp run-ups in some games. And as I said, as long as it's the same for the two teams, the sort of people who concern themselves with preserving the sanctity of records. Do you remember when there was debate about Ireland and Afghanistan? Well, not even that, Sri Lanka. Anytime there was a new team given test playing status, people would say, like, oh no, it'll just invalidate all the records. Teams would be scoring 700 and 800 against them. That does amuse me. I mean, how many records are there in test match cricket that deserve to have an asterisk by them because the conditions were so alien? Yeah. You know, county cricket, very different. Declaration bowling, that kind of thing. But in all fairness, Matthew Hayden scored 380 against a not very good Zimbabwe team.
The day-night thing and then the pitches all plays together, because when that happened, Ian Botham and a bunch of people on Twitter and social media and former players all said, oh, well, you have to throw all the records out now because it's a completely different game, right? Now, those people don't look at cricket records all the time. They also don't contextualize them in any way, shape or form. So if you go through that entire history you talked about, you missed out a couple of things of which you'll know a bit about. So basically, up until 1900, we didn't use liquid manure uniformly in cricket. So I think it was about 1895 that it became in. So before that, the reason that was so hard to bat in international cricket and first-class cricket is literally the ball would hit little chunks of shit on the pitch, right? And fly around, right? Now, that's why George Lohmann's record is so good. And that's why W.G. Grace is seen as a great, despite the fact he's only got a batting average of mid-30s. It's because a batting average of mid-30s, when you're literally having to face balls coming off shit, is quite tough. You then have the fact that South Africa won their first test series on what surface?
Matting.
Matting wickets. Pakistan, I think, might have won their first test series again, I think, was on matting. So you've got two teams who basically started out on matting wickets. And then you've got all the rest of the evolution that you were talking through. Not to mention the quality of the balls has changed. The quality of the bats has changed. The size of the ground, the general upkeep of the ground has all changed. I hate to say to Ian Botham, but his record looks quite unfavorable compared to George Lohmann when you look at day tests. He doesn't quite go to the Lohmann level of averaging. What did Lohmann average against South Africa? 9 or something? 8? So you know, you've got all those sorts of things. And then you're right. South Africa won two test series in the first 40 years, and New Zealand won their first test series after 39 years. there's a lot of batsmen around the world who did very well against some ordinary attacks from those two countries in those days, yeah?
Yeah. Chicken or pig?
And no, it would have been cow shit.
Oh, no. You're kidding.
Yeah, it would have been manure. It would have been chopped up manure, wouldn't it? It was before muckrakers came along. I've actually done a video on this. I went into the archives to find up. So the muckraker was invented somewhere around the mid-1800s when farming became an industry rather than just people doing it on their own. And then it looks like it took until about 1897 for most first-class venues around the world to have access to liquid manure.
Amazing. I love that. I love that. Jared, I need to ask you about boundaries, okay? So people may not know, many of our listeners may not know, that there weren't boundaries in cricket. They weren't introduced until 1870. But I've often wondered, apparently the story goes that what triggered it was a game, an actual game, apparently it's a true story, in which a ball was hit into a tree and the batsman ran 286 times before somebody said enough, or maybe they just ran out of energy. And then, so the MCC were consulted about this, because the boundary was basically formed by the crowd, wasn't it? That big popular game.
Yeah.
And then if the ball was hit into the crowd, they would sort of part and allow the fielder to run after the ball and pick it up. But is the 286 story true?
I don't believe so. And the reason I know this is so weird, man, is you could not have found a more random expert than me. When I went to primary school, very small community school in the outskirts of Melbourne, our librarian was a cricketer, Gary something. I have to look up his name, but he recently messaged me on Facebook because I wrote about this, because he holds the world record for the most runs run in a cricket game. And it's way less than 286. It was, I wish I knew this story better, but I think they ran 28 or 30, hit the ball into the outfield on a big outer suburban Melbourne ground. And councils look after grounds in Australia. It's not like some other countries around the world where the players do, which means the councils don't always get to cut the grass. And in this case, they've smashed the ball out to deep mid-wicket or something. The ball's gone in the grass and these guys have just kept running essentially until they were too exhausted to continue to run. So I know that other story is not true, but I think it does come from a very basic truth where they realize that sort of thing could happen. And it would start to happen. And I think boundaries came in, but if I'm not mistaken, sixes were quite weird. Didn't you used to, at one stage, get five runs for a six and you had to swap ends?
Yeah. They didn't really know what they were doing, did they, when they introduced the boundaries? And six was just based on the number of runs they thought that would have been run on average if the ball had been hit that far into the crowd. And often, you know, the crowd would impinge the fielder and, depending on whether he was the opposition or a home team. So I think it was just it was a random thing. But yeah, it was a five. A six was a five initially.
Yeah. So, I mean, they had no real idea what they were doing. It's funny how so many of those sports kind of got some of the very basics very right. I think four runs and six runs are a very good amount for those shots, especially I think we're seeing now with T20. Like, for the amount of risk that you have to take, I think that makes sense. But I suppose this goes back to the change that more traditionalists in cricket fought more than anything else, which is overarm bowling.
Aha, yes, indeed. I love hearing you talk about subjects that you're not only an expert on, but passionate about. So go on. Your listeners, actually, your regular listeners will probably know, they'll have heard you talk about it, but go on.
So it's really interesting. So basically, cricket was a street game, yeah? As you said, there was a bit of gambling. Two blokes out the corner at the back of their day would do it. Kids would do it. It was usually one-on-one, sometimes two-on-two. Hambledon comes along and essentially formalizes the legal betting, really, as much as the laws. And at that stage, we then have cricket almost set in a little box. We know what it is. And this bloke called Tom Walker comes along, who's a batsman. I mean, he must have been dull as shit to watch. Some of the stories about his innings are legendary. And he decides to bowl one day, and he just sort of pops his arm up, Neil, and tries to bowl, and the posh blokes at Hambledon, not having none of it. I'm not sure he even bowled ever again in a game after that. They were so upset with him. 30 years later, people are still doing this, and Lords are essentially trying to fight it. And of course, the backstory of Lords is one of the most brilliant things. We use this as a holy name. Thomas Lord tried to sell the ground and build flats on it. That's how much he cared about cricket by the end. And so they're trying to fight it. So you then have a couple of people involved. One of them was the Willis family. I think that's how you pronounce it. Essentially, he does it in a game, and because he's a posh boy, he can get away with it. He does it a few times, finally does it at Lords, is called for a no ball, is thrown out of the game. Allegedly, Manus, in this case, the story is so great, jumps on a horse and just rides off into the sunset, never plays another first-class game. That part of the story is true. I don't know if the horse is true, but he literally left the ground, was so upset, never played another first-class game, but they kept fighting. So basically for over 50 years, people kept fighting to stop people from bowling overarm and cricket. And do you know why they did it, Manners? Do you know the fucking kicker of all this was? Is that they were fat, old, wanky, posh gentlemen who basically use 4-pound bats. And if you came in and tried to wang a ball sideways, and we're not even talking about overarm yet, they hadn't even got that far yet. We're talking literally round arm bowling. It was scaring the shit out of 45-year-old men who weren't athletic enough to play a proper sport in the first place. And so they fought it for years. It's ridiculous. And it held cricket back so much because the minute overarm bowling becomes a thing, W.G. Grace invents modern batting and away we go and we've got a proper sport.
What about the story that overarm bowling was adopted en masse, first of all, by women who played the game because they couldn't bowl underarm because of their whalebone skirts?
Yeah, that's all fake.
Is that fake, really?
Yeah, so John Willis's sister, Christiana, I think her name is. So her part in the story gets infused almost 100 years later by her son when he writes about it in an article. And he doesn't mention the dresses in that article, by the way. It's one of those things. It's a bit like, you know, the original UFO story. If you read back the original person who said he saw a UFO, it's actually a long cylinder, but he said it looked like it was moving like a plate. It's a bit like that with the story. I've checked with fashion historians because you know the sort of person I am to have a look at this. And women in England were not using those kinds of dresses at that time. There's no way she would have had that dress. But you've got to remember this. No women were being trained in how to play cricket properly. She was definitely in the backyard playing with her brother who goes on to be the guy who rides off on the horse, right? Who was Jane Austen's nephew. That was her nephew. And her niece was the one that you're talking about, Christiana. If you're in a backyard and you've never been taught cricket correctly, I notice this with my kids. Sometimes they come up with new ways of like giving me the ball. My son's got this incredible way of almost backflipping the ball to me that makes no sense. If you don't teach someone how to do it properly, there is a chance that she did it. Certainly the dresses are not true, and I would doubt how much she was involved. Also, by that point, that whole family, we remember them because they're really posh, yeah? And because of the Jane Austen thing, in actual truth, there is no doubt that for probably best part of 100 years, kids on the streets, posh and poor kids, have been playing this game and probably bowling with round arm. So there you go. But had we not done that, this game wouldn't exist. It just wouldn't exist as a sport. It would be a parlor game. Well, not a parlor game, an outdoor parlor game. Croquet. It would be croquet.
Croquet, exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. We go back 150 years. Men were playing this game wearing cravats and jackets. It wasn't a sport. You could play croquet in a jacket and cravat.
You look at the old photos, even when overarm bowling started, have a look at photos of Spofforth and those guys. They're standing still with their arm up in the air. They do not look like athletes in, I shouldn't say photos, most of them were paintings, but they're not in any action poses. And look at the footwork of the batsmen.
In those very first photographs with the old lime flashes, they had to stand and hold that pose for about 10 seconds and not move. So,
yeah,
they're not surprised there weren't too many action shots. Why don't we let modern cricketers field in gloves? Oh, and we haven't mentioned runners either. The gentleman to whom you refer used to, they wouldn't even pull a hamstring. They'd just get their butler to come and run for them. I think it was Arjuna Ranatunga's fault, wasn't it, that runners were outlawed in the modern game?
I don't know if it was him. I think he's remembered as it because he was the one that exploited the rule better than anyone else in modern cricket.
Was it Ian Healy who said to him, you don't get a runner for being a fat prick?
It was Healy that said that. I reckon it was Sehwag that they were targeting when the actual law changed, if it was any international cricketer, because I think he had started to do it. But you're right, it's a really interesting one too, because baseball, I think, probably took that from cricket. They have these substitute runners occasionally. Don't they, that come in and just do running. So obviously there was a crossover there, but in cricket, yeah, it was because of the lack of athletes. That was a big deal when it changed. I think it's actually probably for the better because I think runners were funnier. There's no doubt about that. But there is something quite great about a cricketer who is injured having to bat, I think, at a certain point as well. And I do mean a leg injury. I don't mean with a broken jaw or the Bert Sutcliffe story or anything like that. But I do mean literally, don't you think there's something great about a hobbled batsman who can't use his feet anymore, so he just has to slog sweep everything?
Yeah, I love it. But I enjoyed runners as well. I'm just saying it's a pretty fundamental change. I mean, that doesn't take too much of a leap of the imagination to say that results of some very important matches would have been different. Not that many, but it's a fundamental change anyway. You see, a lot of changes over the years, recent years, have been brought in or motivated by player safety. So I'm thinking about, everyone complains about overrates. I think teams might get on with it a little bit more if you said, this whole thing about lunch being 40 minutes and tea being 20 minutes, actually, you carry on until you finish your 30 overs. That might be a good motivating thing, but then somebody's going to come along and say, no, that's health and safety, mate. You won't get away with that. That'll never be passed. And there are a lot of things have been changed, you know, extra water breaks. A lot of things are based on health and safety and potential litigation. On that basis, how many ripped fingernails and split webbing would we manage to cut down on if players were able to? They use gloves in practice. So what is it? Is that another traditionalist thing?
Oh, you can't have gloves, mate. We've never worn gloves in cricket.
What I find that very interesting is because we do have protective equipment for fielders, don't we? You can wear shin guards, you can wear a box, you wear a helmet. I can't think of anyone who's ever worn a chest guard, but almost all the other stuff that they can wear, they wear. And we see that as safe. But you're right. I mean, it does make sense. I wonder what kind of gloves you would have to wear that would make those things that much safer. But perhaps you're right. The ones that they use in the fielding practice could be certainly something that we could look at. Would it not just improve the standard of cricket? Because people would take more catches? Is that not a good thing?
Yes, definitely. And also, it would be a bowler's aid. When was the last time we had something that would aid bowlers? If we had slip catches with gloves on that... And I'm not suggesting that you use glue.
Well, players have done that, though, don't slip fielders use resin and things, don't they, sometimes in their hair? I mean, that is something we used to talk about in club cricket, players doing stuff like that. So I'd be shocked if international cricketers haven't done that. Especially so, Aussie rules football, they use resin a lot in their hands. They used to. A lot of them wear gloves now. So you can't tell me that with all the crossover between Aussie rules football and cricket that no Australian slip fielders have gone out with just something a little bit sticky on their hands.
Not much I know about that, but I'd be very surprised if they hadn't. Moving on to the super modern innovations and changes that haven't yet come. In your work as an analyst, you would have do crap load of research on, you know, where the ball travels at which period in the game. And so it occurred to me, and this is a conversation I first had with Mickey Arthur when he was coach of one of the international teams.
He's one of the many.
He's now on to his fourth. It's unbelievable. I remember when it was now. It was between Australia and Pakistan. I said to him, Mickey, on a really flat wicket in a T20 game in the last three or four overs, why do you need a keeper? Do you know what I mean? Because particularly if you've got a bowler who's going to be bowling full and straight and he's mostly going to be hitting the wickets, and then you might say, well, the bats could just leave it. But then you have your third man or your fine leg very fine.
Yeah.
And if he does just leave it, then at best they can push for two. Batsmen, you know, they're not going to be that happy with two, are they? They're looking for fours and sixes. And there's a rule that says you can't have your designated wicketkeeper. Yeah. You can't have him, like, standing at gully. So you dispense with the keeper completely. You take the pads and the gloves off, and you don't have a keeper. Not all the time, obviously.
You know this has happened?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So 5 years ago, Northants tried it.
Oh.
Maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So you're right. And an analyst like me probably came up with it, or a random cricket person probably came up with it. It must have been a very hard thing to convince the team to go with it, but they didn't find it worked. I think if you think Andre Russell's batting on that flat pitch and you can set up a situation where you basically have, as you said, maybe a third man or a fine, whatever it is, whatever system you think would work. And at the very worst, he's going to get two a ball. He scores it more than two a ball. Like Andre Russell legitimately in a normal situation scores at more than two a ball at the death. If he's already 70 off 30 balls and he's in at the death, for me, I'd rather him miss the odd ball and get two runs from that than I would something else. I think you'd have a very fine third man that should be able to cut it off. You could only do it with someone who's bowling slower balls because otherwise they'd just go for four all the time. So that'd be a slow ball bowler with a very fine third man, and then you just have a umbrella field on the deep boundary of long on, mid wicket, and although maybe long off as well, out. And you just bowl very slow balls at and around middle and leg stump. And perhaps it could work, but Northants did try it. So it will happen again. One of the things that I think will happen, and I discussed this with some of the Scotland players when I was there, they were like, what's next? And I said, well, for me, you've got one guy at one end. Let's say you've got Sun on Orion and Chris Lynn playing in a game, right? Chris Lynn scores at something like 12 or 13 runs and over against seam bowling. Sun on Orion scores at something like 12 or 13 runs and over against spin bowling. Why would they take a single? If you're facing seam and you're Chris Lynn and you've accidentally hit the ball to deep backward square, why take the one and get the bloke at the other end who's only going to score at six or seven runs and over? Just stay there. Literally just go, I got this end. Make the other team do that. In fact, not only have I talked to the Scotland, I tried to get a player at St Lucia to do that when he was facing a particular kind of bowling. And he was just like, I would be roasted by the press if I did that. And I was like,
oh, who cares? What do you mean?
It's a good tactic. I'm like, anyway, I have tried to convince them. So there are things like that that I think make a lot of sense because, right, in Test cricket, what a bowler wants to do is bowl as many balls to a batsman as possible because the bowler is the predator and the batsman is the victim in Test cricket. That's basically how it works out. In T20 cricket, it's almost entirely the opposite. What you really want is if you're a good batsman and you can see a bowler for two or three balls in a row, I am up. And it's the baseball rule. It's why baseball rotate through their pitches so much now. They've worked out that through an innings, hitters eventually get to the point where they're like, they can work out the pitcher, right? And in cricket, we have that. So if you've got Chris Lynn facing a seam bowler, you don't want him to get a single and to get the bloke at the other end who's going to struggle against seam on strike. And then next over, Chris Lynn's now facing a spinner. That's the last thing you want. You can literally do that. So I think we will actually see things of that nature. And you might get similar kinds of things in Test cricket more often, where there will be what we would call the Manny Cohen agreed upon single, where Joe Root's facing spin in a test match. Just have the field a little bit deeper, let him get off strike and let the guy at the other end who's maybe not as good at spin face that and get Joe Root facing what he's not as good at his end. So you might get little things like that start to come in. Intentional strike rotation fields.
I like that, yeah. I just want to remind you here, Jared, that about 3 months ago, just before lockdown, actually a couple of weeks before lockdown started, I suggested on air with you that using saliva to shine the ball might be banned. And you thought I'd been on the hallucinogenic toads, didn't you? The reason I bring that up is to ask about the number of overs after which a new ball becomes available in test matches. That's an area that I'm a little vague and hazy on. I know that it hasn't always been 80 overs, but Sachin Tendulkar came up with a good suggestion the other day, didn't he? With bowlers not being able to shine the ball, he said, why not just make the new ball available after 50 overs? And I thought that made a lot of sense. It hasn't always been 80 overs. I know that for a fact. I can't remember.
I reckon it's been 60, 65, 40. Was 40 the lowest
40?
One? I think there's a really low one in there somewhere. And then they realized that they were really hurting the spinners. And I'm trying to think if it was 40 or 45. It's not one of my pet subjects, but I'm pretty sure there was one series when it was incredibly low. It's actually quite tough as a historian to go back and work out what ball the teams were using at any time. So the Sarfraz Nawaz game, and he says it's not reverse swing, even though it is 100% clearly reverse swing. It's actually quite tough to tell what stage the ball was at because it was quite a long innings. I think if you found the original scorecards, perhaps you might be able to put it together. But online on Crick Info and Crick Archive and those sorts of things, it's a bit tougher to work out when the balls were replaced in some of those older games. When you think about it, it's a fundamental change. If you think about how much one-day cricket was changed by having the 25-over balls at either end, and when Srinivasan took over cricket, he thought that was prejudice against Asian teams, which you can see because they wanted the ball to be older for their spinners in the middle overs. And I would say the fundamental flaw in white ball cricket is the white ball is shithouse and it doesn't last. But you know what I mean? So those sorts of things really do affect it. So well, you're also a big advocate for legalized tampering, aren't you?
Yes, but there are conditions. So I think it's absolutely ludicrous that bowlers aren't allowed to throw the ball into old wicket ends to legitimately scuff it up. I mean, it's completely unpoliceable, isn't it? It's the only umpires I can remember who were actually was Ian Gould. Do you remember? He'd tease fielders and say, I thought you had a better arm than that, or, you know, you've got a problem with your elbow. But that's absolutely, definitely should be permitted. And I think that you can do whatever you like with your thumbnails. I'd stop short of taking bottle tops and broken bits of glass onto the field. And I certainly, you know, sandpaper wouldn't make my permitted list. But I was absolutely in favour of Kookaburra developing that wax shining stick that they probably are still developing. And I think nobody knows what's going to work and what isn't going to work. But the umpire keeps the shining material. Perhaps there could be some choices, you know, some Vaseline or whatever. And the umpire keeps it and the bowler gets to apply it for 5 seconds at the beginning of each over. You know, something like that. Yeah. I interviewed Mickey Arthur a couple of weeks ago and he sits on the ICC Cricket Committee, of course, and they came up with all the recommendations for playing cricket in a biosecure environment. And I said to him, Mickey, if the bowlers can't use saliva, and by the way, Jared, I'm still not 100% sure that saliva actually is a polishing agent. I mean, I think it's got more to do with the sugar or whatever they're eating in their mouths. But nonetheless, I said to Mickey, you sit on the cricket committee, you would have debated this, and you've decided to give the bowlers nothing, no compensation whatsoever. Why is that? They can't shine the ball now, and then you vetoed the use of any shining agent. Why did you do that? And he said, because we're all batsmen on the ICC cricket committee. And he was only half joking. It's true. And so what's wrong with picking the seam with your thumbnail? Why is that such a terrible thing?
When you say it like that, I can understand why people are like, yeah, it's a natural thing. You know, you have a thumbnail. But I think you and I know that international players and first-class players use strengthening agents on their fingernails to make them stronger. And there are certain players who will cut their nails in a certain way. So it is like having a bottle top. So that's the problem, isn't it? And maybe we say you can use your fingernails, but a bit like the old children's sports where you check everyone's nails to make sure they're not too long before you go out.
Water polo. It's a water polo check.
Is it water polo? Yeah, I knew there was a sport I'd seen it happen in. But I think there's junior sports. They used to do it a lot too to stop kids scratching each other. But essentially, if you do something like that, I'm up for it. Whoever comes up with these, and the problem with these committees is the ICC committee can't be honest, Manus, right? They can't say, we know that teams have been cheating for, let's see, Safra's 69. Teams have been getting the ball to reverse swing since 69 consistently, and teams have been cheating to get the ball reverse swing since pretty much throughout that entire, but there are some grounds that just help it, and it's not always illegal methods, but generally, 85 to 95% of the time, there's some illegal help that is brought in with the ball reverses, right? And the ICC would have to actually come out at a certain point and admit that all of these things have been going on and they just allowed them to happen. And I think that's part of the reason that they haven't come out and done that. There's no time we've ever played club cricket and you haven't picked up the ball and someone hasn't picked at the seam. It's just a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And in case people are thinking, what does Jared mean when he says strengthening agents? It's actually the material that horse riders, and particularly show jumpers, use to harden the hooves of their horses so that if they do clip a jump, it doesn't split their hooves.
And there's also the mountain climbers have a product as well, which I think a lot of cricketers also own.
Oh, do they really? It used to be just super glue in our day, didn't it?
I can't remember ever going out on a cricket ground with an opening bowler who didn't have a suspiciously shiny forehead.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Why do you think Alan Donald had that white lightning paint on his face?
Well, to be fair, he was probably the only one keeping the white ball together. The most recent one, of course, is the substitutions for concussion and now potentially for injuries, having a first-class game where you can have more than 11 players, which, of course, has meant so many people are up in arms because they don't know that first-class games quite often had more than 11 players before the 1900s.
Yeah, well, exactly. I really, really do believe that the modern game, however you define that, should be an 11-a-side game, other than in the case of concussion. I think that is entirely sensible. And now, of course, don't ask me to explain this one, but now you can, in theory, have a coronavirus COVID-19 substitute, but it is just an 11-a-side game. You haven't asked me about three-team cricket. South Africa at the forefront of innovations. Three-team cricket. Mm-hmm.
So who's behind this? Is it Mark Nicholas? There's a few of our colleagues that are involved in this. Is that right?
Yeah, Francois Pienaar. Or as far as I'm aware, sorry. Francois Pienaar is the chief executive of Three Team Cricket. Mark Nicholas, our colleague at TalkSport, is a shareholder. And do you know what? I think it has a future for schools. My problem with it is that it's 8-a-side. And the main reason that 6-a-side cricket doesn't work is there aren't enough fielders. And the only 6-a-side tournament that has lasted and it remains popular is the Hong Kong Sixes, and that's because everyone gets to go on a massive jolly and go and party for a long weekend, which is fine, which is great. I'm happy with that.
Do you have last man stands in South Africa?
It's part of three-team cricket.
No, there's actually a competition that I think started in Australia and is now sort of filtering around through the UK and other countries around the world, which is, and it's an actual competition called Last Man Stand, although it also has... It also has the last man stands rule. It is 8-a-side cricket, and it's actually been quite popular with people finishing work and going to play a quick game of cricket. So I think eight is the sort of amount of people that you can cover the field a little bit more. I think you're right. Six doesn't make any sense. I don't know if you've ever played in a six-man team, but you just end up on a boundary 100 meters from everyone else. It's such a pointless exercise. It doesn't make any sense. Whereas eight-man cricket, there's a little bit more of that. So it can make sense. So it's interesting. What I don't understand is, have we not invented a format of cricket where young kids are going to be off the field more often than not because their whole team isn't being used? Or have I not looked at the regulations?
You bowl for six overs, you bat for six overs, and you spend six overs in the dugout. That's basically it. And you face six overs from each of the other two teams. So it's two innings of 18 overs. I think it'll be quite inclusive, actually. And it doesn't have to be six. You know, you can do it in multiples of 10 and have 60 overs rather than 36. And I just think that it works. It's a throwback to those old school athletics meetings. You know, that was the only sport that I can recall where you'd played against more than one team. And I think it could work. But at international level or at senior first class, even club level, I think it's a gimmick. And I think the company has been trademarked and it's a money-making tool for the shareholders involved. But I do really, I'd be quite in favour of trying it out at school levels because everybody gets to bat and bowl, probably more chance of everybody getting to bat and bowl. And there's even talk about, you know, rotating the fielders. And it's, I know this will sound patronising, but it's a childish concept. And I mean that in a good way.
Mm. It's quite interesting. We're just getting to a point where we are exploring what can be done with cricket. So the 100, let's be honest, the way that they released it and organised it was a clusterfuck of an omni-shambles. But the basic premise of making T20 cricket much different to Test cricket and One Day cricket is a solid marketing idea. And there's like really little things that I think we're so wedded to because we're traditionalists. I'd used air quotes there. That won't work well on the podcast, but you understand what I mean. Whereas in actual fact, we want fielders to be at their absolute maximum. We want the Ben Stokes catch and the Sheldon Cottrell catch to be a normal event. And at the moment, having worked with cricket teams, you understand the amount of effort that your best fielders have. They spend all their time sprinting from end to end. There's no reason why we can't have 10 overs from one end and then 10 overs from the other end. In fact, the only reason I could find that that wouldn't work is that it might be too intense for an umpire to do 10 overs without a break. But I think they'd eventually get used to that. There are heaps of things that we could do that would be quite interesting. Like we could actually take T20 cricket and make it really hyper-specialist in a way that Test cricket and One Day cricket won't ever need to be. So you could pick five specialist bowlers and 10 specialist batsmen and you could do all those sorts of things if you're willing to experiment with the game. That would actually improve the quality of the cricket on the field. It would bring in other problems. But the biggest problem now is that no one is really running cricket. And so you have the three-team thing and you have the 10-over thing and you have the 100-over thing. And you're going to have all these different little, you know, subsections. There's a certain point where cricket is spending more of its time eating itself than it is actually growing itself.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be 10 overs from one end followed by 10 overs from the other, but five, you know, five, 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 five. There's a lot of changing of ends that goes on in cricket, and it takes up a lot of time. Even if you just had two overs from each end, you know, just have 12 balls from one end. I enjoy that. A little while ago, you were talking about shithouse innovations, like completely nonsensical rules, and you wrote something quite whimsical and very critical of the changes being proposed, or they may even have been sanctioned already now, in the Big Bash. What amuses me there is that Cricket Australia can't just say, we expanded too much, there's too much of it, people are bored, we need to go back to a manageable size, 6 weeks is too long for a tournament. You know, that's just no. We have to innovate. Let's get the men with ponytails into our marketing room and get them to come up with something exciting and sexy. I thought that the bonus point for the team ahead after 10 overs was interesting. And I thought about that and I can see it being both a complete shower of shit and being quite fun. It's like a mini power play in the middle. Mm. But the really, really stupid one for me, is in a game that it's all about speed, fitting it into 90 minutes each innings, keeping it rolling, keeping it. So you have to bowl no balls again, but you have to bowl. Hang on, what was it? What was the thing about wides that they were introducing?
So a wide is now a free hit.
So how long is that going to take?
Yeah, well, there'll be more balls in the boundary because, I mean, if you look at it purely on a mathematical thing, a free hit goes at 12.2 runs and over, and a normal ball goes at 8 runs and over. So you've basically completely changed everything. it's so weird because there are actual things that they could do. And I think the 100 tried to do this and just got up its own ass a little bit and maybe didn't have adults in the room. And I say this, Trent Woodhill was in the room, one of my friends. I make fun of him all the time, so it's okay. But I think they needed a couple of adults in the room to literally say, innovation is great and there are things that we can do that can move cricket forward right here, right now. And it will make the game more entertaining and more fun and maybe more captivating for fans, right? But you needed someone to say every time someone came up with an innovation, why are we doing that? What is it going to do and what are the ramifications? What will change here? And literally get a bunch of people to poke holes in it. And I think the problem with the Big Bash changes and the 100 changes is that they're changes for change's sake and for basic excitement. And excitement is, it's waning. Cricket games are exciting for many different reasons and for many different times. If you want to make a change to make the game exciting and better, I'm all for it. But you actually need to think these things through. And I'm not sure at the moment that they are doing that. And honestly, I don't think that the wide thing helps the game at all. It's one of those things, isn't it? There's a bunch of things that you always get. So when the 100 went to Mumsnet and they said, are you more likely to come to this thing that you don't like if it's shorter, right? And my basic thing of always is, yeah, if you could make Russian films half an hour shorter, I'm more likely to watch them, right? I'm still not going to watch a Russian film. I actually like a lot of Russian films, so that's not a perfect analogy. But the ballet, if you made the ballet 10 minutes shorter and you told me it was going to be shorter, I'd be like, yeah, I'm more interested. I'm still not going to go because I fundamentally don't like the ballet and I don't understand the ballet. I'm not interested in the ballet. Making it 10 minutes shorter is not going to do that. And I think that too many of these changes are things like that. Wouldn't it be great if there were more sixes? So yeah, I don't like that thing, but when they hit that thing really far, how many great games of cricket, there's not a six even hitting? It's looking through those sorts of things. And that's where these problems come about. There are many problems within our sport that we could fix. And instead, we've got these two sides going on at all times. It needs to be more exciting. Nothing could ever change. And so there's actually a middle ground where we can improve things and we don't do anything to do with any of that. I give you a perfect example of this. There is absolutely no reason to use the heavy roller on a cricket pitch once the test has started. It is supposed to degrade.
I like that a lot. And I was wondering if you were going to mention it. There's many proponents of the theory that the roller should not be used at all, just a brush and a sweep. I'd be very happy if the heavy roller was no longer part of the groundsman's kit. Although there are occasions where the heavy roller breaks a pitch up, doesn't it? And actually increases deterioration. But that's something that I think is really, really interesting. And so how about, you know, I was saying, if some test matches are going to be played over 4 days and the iconic ones stay at 5 days, fine, as long as it's the same for both teams. So how about on the world's really super flat pitches, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, how about it being an option for two teams to have as a playing condition specific for their series that we won't use any rollers?
It would be great. It won't happen because the batsmen are captains, yeah?
Yeah.
That's why it won't happen. I could see that. I can also see away teams deciding on those sorts of things as well. And I think fundamentally, when we're making all these changes, especially when we're making changes to test cricket, we need to work out why test cricket is still around, let's say 250 years from its original invention, right? Sort of the start of what became three-day cricket through to where we are now. The reason is that it has a lot of variables that other sports can't have. You could almost say it has a bunch of design flaws. You wouldn't invent the stumps at the size that they are now, because it doesn't make any sense. You make them flat. There would be certain things that you would change throughout the game. But because of that, what cricket should be doing is leaning into those design flaws. And one of them is the fact that a basketball court doesn't deteriorate during a game, right? We actually have a sport where fundamentally, even more than golf, even the greens in golf don't change as much as a cricket pitch can. Let's lean into that. Make the fourth innings great again. Essentially, those are the sorts of things I think we can do. And it's the same with one-day cricket. We came up with one-day cricket on a whim. We didn't really think it through. And we came up with the five bowlers, right? But essentially what that means is that Scott Styris becomes a legend of a one-day cricketer because he has to bowl the fifth overs while being a top six batsman. We could actually go, fuck it. We'll put a maximum of, let's say, 14 overs so that guys don't get overbowled in a one-day international. So 14 overs, I think, is fair. Maybe even 13 overs, which I think they did in Australian domestic cricket 1 year. But then we'll mean the best bowlers will go up against the best batsmen in every game. We don't need bullshit all-rounders that aren't really that good at batting or bowling. There are certain things we can do within the game to improve the game and lean into the great nature of the sport. Instead, we should do free hit wides. Sometimes I'm just like, there are other ways of making the game better. I always look at the NFL as such a ridiculous sport. You do have the absolute best cornerback is going up. That's all that cornerback can do is be a cornerback. And he's going up against a wide receiver who can only be a wide receiver, which means at that one moment, you have the best cornerback and the best wide receiver out on the field, one trying to catch the ball and one trying to stop him. We can do those sorts of things with cricket because we do sort of, to a certain extent, in test cricket. And you can still be innovative, as we've already talked about with the fielding. I want Ben Stokes and Kyron Pollard and Martin Guptill to be at long on for 10 straight overs and do incredible things without them using their energy to go back and forth across the ground. Little things like that we can lean into. And I think that's where we should be going.
I like it. You know, I said right at the beginning that the only thing that I could find that hadn't been changed in cricket.
What was that?
It's been the topic of conversation now, specifically around the women's game. But you mentioned the stumps. Of course, there used to be two stumps and one bail at the beginning. So everything has changed. The ball has changed. The one thing that I cannot find has changed is the length of the pitch.
Mm. And that must have been 1700s, yeah?
Because it's the length of a chain. As you know, there are 10 chains in a furlong. And it was felt that any other material used to measure the length of a pitch might stretch or like a rope. So the one thing that was consistent was a chain. That's 22 yards. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we haven't changed. I mean, LBW laws have changed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The way we bowl, the way we play the game has obviously changed massively. The bats, I mean, in fact, the bats are the only other thing that would be almost as old. But if you look at the footage of the original bats, they're basically hockey sticks because the balls were delivered along the ground. And there's also, of course, at Hambledon, someone turned up with a bat as wide as the stumps, didn't they? And so they had to change the width of the bats. And to be fair, we've changed the laws on bats again recently with the MCC. I think their ludicrous idea, but their idea of the diameter of the bats. Players didn't always wear whites. They don't always wear whites now. You might have it there. You might have it. The length of the pitch might be the only thing. Because a lot of people will straight away then say, oh, we always play on grass. And it's like, we don't. We haven't always played on grass. And we don't always play on grass. I don't know if you know this. There's an AstroTurf cricket ground in Hong Kong because they don't have that many places with actual grass. So there's literally a playing field that is AstroTurf. So, yeah, I think you might have it there. I mean, of course, the minute we put this podcast up, someone's going to come up with another one.
That was the idea.
In the comments.
That was the idea.
Now, just before you go, you have released an audiobook of your original book, which I have somewhere downstairs. The title of your book is The Greatest South African Cricketers Ever. No, it's not called that. Which one did you do? You've released a lot of books. There's the beer drinking book.
The Beer Drinker's Guide to Losing Weight. Good luck finding that one. That's like 25 years.
I've got it downstairs.
Oh, have you?
Of course I do.
I think I gave you one last time you popped
around. No, I haven't already. I don't know why I have it. I think I might have found it. You know, when you're in Headingley, they have that great old couple that run the book selling stand out near the rugby stand. I always pick like random books by my friends who, it's always the books that my friends would be embarrassed at to actually be mentioned, like the beer drinking one. Although I'm sure you're proud of that.
It's the Proteas 20 years, 20 matches. It traces South Africa's first 20 years post-isolation from Clive Rice's three-match ODI tour to India to the 92 World Cup. And it's not just 20 matches. It's pretty much a history of the first 20 years. So, and of course, next year, it'll be 30 years. So I'll have to do an update. But during lockdown, I did two constructive things. I learnt how to make cider because there was an alcohol ban for 2 months of our lockdown. And it was more on principle, really. And it was totally shit. And it hardly had any alcohol in it. It was quite tasty. It was sort of like a lightly sparkling apple juice. And I recorded my book and produced an audiobook, which was very therapeutic.
I loved that every other white person in the world during lockdown came up with a podcast and you took it to an old school level and went audiobook.
There are a lot of podcasts out there, aren't there?
Yeah. Neil Manthorpe, thank you very much for coming on.
It's an absolute pleasure, mate. Hopefully see you sometime soon.
Thank you for listening. You can follow my guest at Neil Manthorpe on Twitter. Please review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere and everywhere. Please tell everyone about it. We're really trying to get this podcast out to as many people as possible. The fact this podcast exists is because of the people who support us at Patreon. So thank you so much to all of you. Red Inca is made by me, Jared Kimber. Nick McCorriston pleases your ears. And our theme tune is called The Prisoner by the Red Crickets.
Red Inca listener, don't forget to also subscribe and listen to Double Century, a podcast where I trawl through old newspaper reports and bitter books from former players to tell the story of our great game. Find Double Century in your podcast apps.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.